One of the arguments that we contend with over here at Lithos Cry is that contemporary Christian music, especially Christian rock and Christian metal, is nothing more than just worldliness propped up to look godly. Based upon your research and working on this project, how much validity is there to that argument? With us this evening is Marshall Terrell. He is the author of the book, The Jesus Music, a book that accompanies a documentary film by the same name. Marshall, thank you so much for taking the time to interview with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So before we dive into a discussion concerning your book and contemporary Christian music, can you tell us a little bit about your personal music journey? What kind of music did you enjoy listening to growing up? And what type of music do you enjoy listening to today?
Well, my tastes have not changed in 40 or 50 years. When I was about 10 years old, there were two double albums that came out called The Beatles 1962 through 66 and The Beatles 1967 through 70. And my older brother, Michael, about 4 years older than myself, had these albums and was playing them. And I was listening. I was like, I know these songs from somewhere. But keep in mind, I was 10 years old, so I didn't have a frame of reference for anything. And so I was listening to these songs, and I was just going crazy, and I loved it. And then the next album that I bought was Sgt. Pepper. And then from there, it was just full on. I mean, I was a complete Beatles freak. And then, of course, when I got a little bit older, I got into the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and all the great rock of the 60s and 70s. So, and I call myself a music snob because I was raised on that music. And so to me, anything that comes after that just doesn't compete. So I've been very myopic in my musical taste, with the exception of, I think, Collective Soul, who I'm friends with, skipped a generation. And they produce a similar sound as the Beatles in terms of melody and arrangements. So it's 60s and 70s and Collective Soul, and that's about it.
What is your favorite Beatles song?
Well, that's tough because, you know, they're such an incredible band. You got to pick 10. One that's going to play at my funeral is going to be In My Life. And then, of course, I love the song Rain, which is the B-side to Paperback Writer. I constantly find myself listening to the White Album and Revolver. And I hate to say it, it sounds terrible, it sounds tacky. I love their drug phase.
You know, there's a lot of people that I've come across that really do enjoy the Beatles during that phase. I mean, either way, either high or off drugs, they were great musicians. Either way that you cut it. I mean, my mom was she was into Beatlemania when she was in college and growing up. She was all into that. And you go through her record collection, you can find every Beatles album that ever came out. And it's kind of interesting because it jumped from Beatles to ABBA. And we had ABBA playing in the house all the time when I was growing up. So let's talk about the book, The Jesus Music. How were you selected to write this book that accompanies the documentary film by the same name?
Well, I knew the Irwin brothers, the folks who directed this movie, through a documentary that we worked on called Steve McQueen, American Icon. And that was, when I say I worked on, I executive produced it. I brought the people in, interviewed them. And of course, they shot this incredibly beautiful film. At that point, I was like, wow, these guys are good. The way they cut it, the way they put it together, and the way it looks. I mean, just beautiful cinematography. So I worked with them on that, and then we worked it together again on a documentary that hasn't come out yet. It's going to be on Johnny Cash. So then I got a phone call out of the blue from one of the producers, Joshua Walsh, and he told me, this was during the pandemic, hey, we're about three quarters finished with a new documentary we're doing called Jesus Music, and it's about the history of contemporary Christian music, and we'd like you to write a companion book. And I said, honestly, Josh, I don't know anything about CCM. I really don't. I said, I know everything about, you know, classic rock and roll. And he said, hey, you know, we're going to send you some rough cuts of the film so that you can see what the story arc is, and then you can write it based on that. So I thought, okay, easy enough. And so as I started writing the book and I saw these rough cuts, I was really enthralled by the storyline because, you know, the main thing that hooked me was the fact that they were chronicling Christian artists who had failures in their personal life. And sometimes it was ugly and it was messy. And I think people really relate to that. And I related to that. So after a while, I really started getting into it. So I took what they wrote with the story arc, and then I kind of went off on my own and did some other things to make the book just a little bit different than the movie. So that's how that project got started.
So when you started this, you were only vaguely familiar with CCM and the Jesus movement. How did this vague familiarity with the topic actually assist you rather than hinder you in the writing process?
Well, when I was growing up, I mean, I come from a Christian household. And so coming of age in the 70s, a lot of that Jesus music movement drifted into our church. And after every church service, we would go to the Christian bookstore. And so there was like this whole groundswell that was happening. There was the music. There was movies. There was books. I can remember going to the Christian bookstore and getting The Hiding Place, The Cross and Switchblade, Run Baby Run. And believe it or not, last night I had dinner with a lady by the name of Cookie Rodriguez, who did a book called Please Make Me Cry. And
wow,
it was the first time I saw her since I was 10 years old. And we just started talking about that whole era. And so I grew up with that firsthand. So I had that firsthand knowledge of the Jesus movement. But what I didn't know until I saw the rough cuts was how it started. So I had some vague familiarity with it. And of course, my mom played a lot of the early Jesus music folks, Evie Tornquist, Bill Gaither, and a lot of Andre Crouch.
This was a mammoth undertaking for you to do. I understand there was a tight deadline for you to write this book in, and you cover, I've read the book. I've read it. I absolutely love it. And it covers 50 years of the history of contemporary Christian music. It's very thought-provoking, a lot of insights, a lot of things I didn't know. So in starting this big project, how did you determine where you're going to start your research?
Well, you know, when you say it was mammoth for the film producers because they interviewed 200 people.
Oh, wow.
So I got the best. So they were sending me these rough cuts. So again, I already knew what the story arc was going to be. So that part, that was easy. What I had to decide was like who to leave in, who to leave out, which rabbit hole to go down, and you know, where to go. So it was really, I wouldn't say it was an easy project, but I had it much easier than the Irwin brothers and Joshua Walsh. So they've got so much more material. I'm going to turn this camera over to my paperwork where I printed out all the interviews.
And okay.
I hope you can see this. Hold on a sec. Let's see. Am I getting there?
Yeah, you are. That is a stack of paper. Wow.
Yeah. Look at this.
You see the Stones? Hey, Rolling Stones.
You see the Beatles?
There's the Beatles. Yep.
And there's John Lennon.
Look at that. Nice.
And then there's Steve McQueen.
Oh, wow. You got a sweet setup over there, man. That is sweet.
Yeah. You can tell I really do love music. I love rock and roll. But yeah, that stack of paper, you know, it's unfortunate that I wasn't able to do more, but we were on such a time crunch. So yeah. I had 3 months to write it, but what I like to do when I write books is I like to give myself a month to edit and sweet. So I wrote it in 2 months and then a full month of editing and sweetening and deciding what to leave in and what to leave out. So yeah, it was a busy project, but it was a fun project. I probably had more fun on this project than I have on any other book.
Well, definitely. It's something that you're passionate about, the music and the rock and roll. And I have to ask this question because writing is such an arduous task. How did you discipline yourself to take 2 months to do that? Did you have people slide quesadillas under the door while you were writing or what?
You know, it wasn't that. Once you get started, it's like this snowball effect. You know, you push that snowball uphill and then you get to a point where it just goes downhill and you're catching that wave. So I was telling somebody the other day, so when I'm doing a book, I'll write every day. And I keep in mind, I have a full-time job. I work at Arizona State University. So after work, you know, I'll come home at 5, I'll have dinner, and about 6 o'clock till about 9 o'clock, I'll write 3 hours a night. I'll take off a Friday, but then I'll work, because by Friday I'm pretty tired. I'll spend a whole Saturday and about half of a Sunday. And Monday through Wednesday, I can get a chapter done. So I can do about 2 to 3 chapters a week. And so once you get on that track, then, you know, you're running and you're going pretty good. So, and the other key is I have a great editor. So I'll send the material to him. He'll edit it as I finish it and clean it up a lot. You know, usually when you're on the time constraint, or if you're not on the time constraint, you edit it much later. But I was slipping in these chapters and editing as we went along. He cleaned up a lot of it to the point where when I got done, you know, it was like getting a fifth draft as opposed to a first draft. So those are all the trades that you learn along the way.
Wow, that takes a lot of discipline to do that. And it's very, very impressive, especially, as I said, I've read the book. It's very well put together, very well thought out, and extremely, extremely thought-provoking. And I want to talk about some thought-provoking things right now, because one of the arguments that we contend with over here at Lithos Cry is that contemporary Christian music, especially Christian rock and Christian metal, is nothing more than just worldliness propped up to look godly. Based upon your research and working on this project, how much validity is there to that argument?
You know, I don't believe that at all. These are artists that have labeled themselves as Christian artists. And I wouldn't say they have pigeonholed themselves, but they have labeled themselves as Christian artists. And, you know, they are sticking by that. So, you know, just by the declaration that they're CCM artists, I mean, that to me, that says a whole lot. So, and then of course, the way they live their lives, the way that they conduct themselves, I mean, it's the whole thing. So, I mean, for someone to say, well, because that's not the shortcut. The shortcut is rock and roll. If you want to make money, if you want to make a living, the shortcut is not to declare yourself a CCM artist. So I have a lot of respect for those people.
That's something that really became evident to me in the book is the sacrifice that these people put into what they did, pouring into their passion, their art form, and what they believe in, and the personal hurt that a lot of them had to go through with the accusations that were thrown at them, especially the guys from Petra, the guys from Striper, when they were doing what God had put in them to do and the criticism that they were getting. So who would you say are the harshest critics of CCM? Would you say that it's the faith-based community, or would you say that it's people outside of the faith-based community?
You know, I interviewed John Schlitt from Petra, and what he said was, you know, he thought he was going to get, bitten by the secular community. But he said what really hurt was the fact that most of the criticism came from the faith-based community. And then there was a gentleman whose name escapes me that was interviewed in the movie and in the book and quoted in the book. He said, you know, he's a therapist for artists. He said, I've dealt with the country artists, I've dealt with rock artists. And those audiences are quicker to forgive than the faith-based world. So, but what I don't want to say is that it's that way now. It was that way then.
Okay.
I'm not so sure it is that way now, because when that was happening, we're talking about the 80s. And so we're talking about, you know, elders in the church and televangelists that were just starting out in the 80s that needed fodder for whatever that they chose to criticize. So I feel like that maybe has changed in the last 40 years. So I really do believe that.
Yeah, that was very interesting to me, reading that point in the book, especially about Jerry Falwell. I'm a Liberty University graduate myself, how he was against it at first, and then all of a sudden, you know, he embraced it, and even the 700 Club with Pat Robertson and started to embrace it. And then all of a sudden, we have DC Talk coming out of Liberty University. We have Mark Lowry coming out of Liberty University as well, and how that has shifted in a lot of places. Why do you think CCM has been so controversial? And why do you think that even today, there is still a little bit of controversy that we do contend with over here on this end? Why do you think there's all this controversy over it?
Well, I think it's just, I think the faith-based world wants to compare it to secular music, and then the secular world gets down on it as inferior. So it seems like CCM kind of gets it from both sides. The biggest surprise, frankly, was the fact that it caught up to the secular music world. Again, I'm one of those rock music snobs. And so, but the way that I see things is that, professionally speaking, CCM really got its start in 1972. And 1972, as a recent CNN documentary pointed out, that was the height of the rock and roll era. That was more people were attending rock concerts and sporting events. It grossed $8 billion in revenue, which surpassed the movie industry, if you can believe that. And in 72, wow, the movie industry had movies like The Godfather, Deliverance, The Poseidon Adventure, Cabaret. I mean, it was a great year for cinema, but music far outpaced it. So so the year 1972 was interesting as a great marker, because that's when Expo 72 occurred, and that's when Billy Graham had given contemporary Christian music and the Jesus movement his stamp of approval, which he also did again when rap started coming in and DC Talk started coming in to play. But the way I saw it was, so the starting point for CCM really is 1972. And then by the 90s, I mean, they were always kind of following secular music in terms of trends, in terms of the sound of music. And by the time you get to the 90s, they both have kind of caught up to each other. Or I should say CCM has caught up to secular music in terms of sales, in terms of exposure. Now there's crossover. Amy Grant's, you know, on The Tonight Show. She's selling out the LA Forum, which was only reserved for big acts like Van Halen. I remember Paul McCartney and Wings, and there's 76 tour. That was their last set of shows. The Eagles. So she was on par with those folks. That's pretty amazing. And then, of course, then we get to the new millennium, and then everything changes. And yes. There's a little bit of technology that levels both industries, and then they're both at the same playing field again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how that happened with Napster, and it just kind of blew everything right up. And now, you know, it's the level playing field for everybody. And that's one of the things that I enjoy is working with artists now that are not very prominent. I do get to work with some of them. And they're making their way through this new medium now and on that level playing field. So in your research, which CCM artists have you found to be the most inspiring, not just because of their message, but really because of the sacrifice and what they gave personally to help advance this art form?
Well, there's several levels of that, you know. I mean, we have to first credit Larry Norman, I think, who is perhaps the godfather of CCM. And he helped perfect that rock star quality that he brought to CCM. But then, you know, somebody has to follow them and then take it to another higher level. And then, of course, that was Amy Grant. Yes. And I find it interesting that she is like the biggest selling star of CCM. And it's not even close. I mean, the second closest, I think, is Michael W. Smith. But, you know, her sales compared to his, it's not even close. So you know, with the secular rock world, it's this macho, always guys dominating. But in CCM, you know, she is the top person. So I find that interesting. And then now a lot of these new artists, I mean, I don't know if you could consider them new, but people like Toby Mac and Lecrae and Lauren Daigle, they're now taking it to another new level.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like that old saying, you stand on the shoulders, you know, of the people that came before you.
Yeah. There's always a foundation that's been built before you get to do what you do. And it's interesting how you mentioned Amy Grant, because the first time I ever heard or saw Amy Grant was in the 80s. I was a teenager and I was watching the Christmas tree lighting at the White House in Washington, D.C. And she performed live Wonderful Counselor. I wasn't even a believer yet. And I was like, that was awesome. And that performance that she did still sticks in my mind. And I've always had deep admiration for Amy Grant since I saw that. That was back in the 80s. And there she was at the White House, you know, and that just shows how things have evolved for CCM. So now that you've been exposed to a wide array of genres of CCM and a wide array of artists, which would you say is your favorite artist or genre in CCM?
Well, I can definitely tell you my favorite genre is the Jesus movement, because that's what I grew up with and knew. And I like the fact that these pioneers were just, you know, they wanted to create a new music. And they wanted their own thing, you know, but they didn't know quite what it was, what they were looking for, but they created it. And out of these church basements evolved a multi-billion-dollar industry. And it wouldn't have come had it been not been for the pioneers. But, you know, given that, again, we talked about how, you know, people standing on the shoulders of other people, just the evolution of the industry fascinates me, you know. You know, as it goes from Jesus music to, and here's a person that's often overlooked in CCM. That's BJ Thomas. He was the first mainstream artist that decides that he's going to get into Christian music and puts a nice slick polish and a pop sound on it and kind of carries that all the way to the 80s, where then you have Amy Grant. And so it's just an interesting, fascinating evolution to watch.
BJ Thomas was one of my favorites as a young child. I had a little radio that you would wind up and it played Raindrops Keep Falling on Your Head. And that was one of my favorite songs. And whenever it came on the radio, I'd start to flip out. So, and I did not know that BJ Thomas crossed over into CCM. I had no idea until I read your book. That was very eye-opening for me. I was like, oh, wow, that is so cool. So one of the other things that I really appreciate about your book is you spend a lot of time in the first chapter describing the cultural context from which CCM was born. And can you give us a brief synopsis of that cultural context? And do you see any similarities between then, when CCM was born, and the time that we're living in today?
Well, I'll answer the last question first. That was, I absolutely see a huge parallel between what's happened now and what's going on in the 60s. As a matter of fact, my mom's still with us, so she's 81. And a lot of people that are older, I asked them, I said, hey, do you see parallels? And they said, yeah, not only do I see parallels, but it's worse today than it was back in the 60s, which is hard to imagine, because I remember reading about the 60s as a kid and thinking, oh man, what a terrible time that must have been, and how, you know, our government was almost going to be overthrown, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, here we are January 6th. We almost have our state capital, our nation's capital being invaded. And so we see that. We see full scale riots everywhere. We see, you know, craziness. And I would have thought that I would have never seen that in my lifetime. So the roots of CCM can be traced probably, you know, to John F. Kennedy and that his assassination, because that's when this root of discontent started taking place. And all throughout the 60s, you know, it starts to snowball with Vietnam, and it starts to snowball with protests and, you know, what's going on in college campuses. And as a matter of fact, you know, like I said, I work on a college campus. And, you know, I saw a major protest just the other day in person as I was trying to get out of my building. So, you know, again, I go back to, it's just, I see so much of today and what happened in, let's say, let's just pinpoint that to 1968, all the craziness that was going on then. So that's how CCM evolved from all that discontent, you know. So you know, maybe perhaps there'll be some great new music that evolves out of this.
That was going to be my next question to you is, because we see so many parallels right now, do you think we're going to see another revolution in Christian music? And based upon your research and everything you've been looking at and analyzing, I love putting on the scholar's cap here doing this. What do you think it's going to look like? What do you think this revolution is going to look like if there is another one in Christian music? Or do you think it's already started?
You know, it's really tough to put your finger on when things happen, when a movement is occurring. I always say for myself, it takes a good 10 years in looking back to start formulating and tracing history. But I will say, as a kid, I remember when disco music came out, I was telling everybody how crazy this would be and how 30 years later we would look back and say, boy, that was a terrible fad. But I digress. I actually like disco music now. That's the funny thing. I hated it because I was a rock snob. And now I like it because it just brings me back to a time that was just kind of fun and light. But to get back to your point, it's really tough to pinpoint when movements are happening. I think the last movement we had in CCM is the technology one with Napster and how it leveled both industries, both the secular and CCM. And so, and again, we could only really see that Napster was about 20 years ago. So to my point, you know, it takes a good 10 years to really figure out kind of like where we are in terms of history.
It's kind of one of those things where you have to look back at it and then realize it was a movement. Is that the case, really?
Exactly. Well, one of the people that was quoted in the book, a gentleman in second chapter of Acts says, you know, when you're a pioneer, you don't know you're a pioneer when you're doing it, because you're basically, you know, you're starving and you're, you know, you're dry. You're hoping that there's enough money in the collection plate for gas to get back home. So, you know, they'll smile and they say, yeah, pioneer, but, you know, didn't know I was a pioneer then.
No, you're a starving artist at that point in time is really what it comes down to. So why would you say that it's important that both the faith-based community and those not part of the faith-based community understand the Jesus movement and understand the history of CCM? Why is this book, The Jesus Music, and the documentary important to our culture as a whole?
Well, I think it's just a simple, because it is history. I didn't look at this book as doing the history of CCM. I looked at it as, this is history and pop culture. This is, you know, this is another legitimate genre. People will be writing history books about rap. They'll be obviously they've written a lot about rock. They've written some about disco, and CCM is definitely a genre in and of itself. And now that we kind of know the history of it, we have to respect what has occurred and respect the sacrifices that people made, because the sacrifices just weren't made by artists. They're also made by executives who took chances. And I'll even go as far to say executives at secular music labels who set up CCM labels because they knew that there was money to be had. And, you know, people always talk negatively about money, but it's what kind of keeps the engine going. And it helps fuel the fire for others to come along and for the industry to get bigger and to get better.
Yeah, it takes money to get stuff done, doesn't it?
Sure does. All the way from guitar strings to to jets and limousine. That's what I say. And by the 1990s, it became a jets and limousine world in CCM. And but the funny thing is, it's not really, I don't know if it's that way any longer. I don't think it is, because in the movie, there's an exchange between Amy Grant and Michael J. Smith at the end of the film where they're talking about, oh, remember the good old days? Remember when there was like mailbox money? Remember when we were selling lots of CDs?
Yeah.
So it's funny to hear these two people who probably made more money in CCM than anyone else, and they're talking about the good old days.
Yeah, it's really interesting you say that, because with one of the major bands that I've had the privilege of working with our Rock Fest in Charleston, when they came, I was watching them move their own amps and equipment up on the stage. And I'm like, this is so totally different from what it used to be.
That's painful to hear.
It's different. And they were just like, hey, we just want to play and we want to minister. That's what this is about. And it was just really amazing to watch that. And they didn't, you know, there wasn't a complaint about it at all. It's just, this is the way it is. And we want to get our art out and we want to minister to people. I'm like, that's awesome. Of course, we did have helpers to help them, but they, you know, did a lot of the work on their own. So speaking of work, you're back to work on another book right now. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Give us a sneak peek of what you're working on.
Yeah, I just finished the photo caption section and the book is essentially done now, and it's with Greg Laurie, and it's called Lennon, Dylan, Alice, and Jesus. And it's a look at the spiritual lives of rock stars through the decades. So we'll examine people like Elvis, Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, everybody who might have been a rock star who became a Christian. So, and then we look at, I mean, there was a period there where John Lennon, believe it or not, was a born-again Christian. It wasn't a very long period, but we examine that. That's an entire chapter. We do an entire chapter on Bob Dylan. If you recall, he did 3 gospel-infused albums back in the late 70s and early 80s. And so, you know, that's one to look out for in May. So that was another fun project to do.
And what is the title of that book again?
Called Lennon, Dylan, Alice, and Jesus. And Alice is for Alice Cooper, who many people might not know is a really devoted, dedicated, born-again Christian. Good guy. Yes. And he lives here in Phoenix, our family knows his. But beyond that, he just does so much for the community that people would not know. They'll know in this book what he's like now, but he's a very, very dedicated Christian.
He is. And I was sharing this story with you a couple days ago. I was going on a church retreat with several pastors. This was many years ago. And on the way in the van, one of the pastors started reading this beautiful writing about the beauty of prayer and seeking the Father's face, and just read it. It was like, Glenn, who do you think wrote that? I was like, oh, it had to be Charles Spurgeon. He's like, no. I was like, David Wilkerson? No. I was like, Jonathan Edwards? He's like, no, Alice Cooper wrote it. And that's when my eyes started to really open. I was like, whoa, God is a lot bigger and more mysterious and moves in a lot more ways than I think in my tiny mind. And that's when my mind started to expand a little bit. And I've always had a great deal of respect for Alice Cooper. And a lot of the videos that he puts on YouTube as well, talking about his faith, it's just so refreshing to hear. Marshall, before we close, do you have anything else that you would like to share with us this evening?
Nothing that I can think of off the top of my head. Oh, wait, I do. The book and the DV are packaged together now, and that comes out tomorrow, and that's in all Walmarts across the nation. So great timing.
Perfect timing. So you can get the Jesus Music, the book, and the DVD in package at Walmart, a total package set. Right. Marshall, thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed this interview, and I'm looking forward to your next book. I am definitely going to read that book.
Thank you. Hey, it was so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Get Revelation Rockfest 2022 update.
All right, we've got time for a quick Get Revelation Rockfest 2022 announcement. Get Revelation Rockfest Music and Arts Festival 2022 is going to be taking place on Saturday, May 14th. at the Hanahan Amphitheater in Charleston, South Carolina. This is going to be an all-day, all-ages event, and our headline band this year is Warriors of Light. And just before Warriors of Light takes the stage, we are going to have Miss Jenna Parr. Some of the opening acts this year include Xandria Cross, Nettie, Tricord, Red Calling, The Last Trumpet, Armor of God. It is going to be an all-day event. And for those of you in Charleston, yes, Charleston's own Ziggy is once again going to be taking the stage. Get those tickets now. And until next week, peace out and rock on.
Lithoscry.com.